Good morning. I'm Robert Graham for the appellants in this matter. As the Court is aware, this entire appeal turns on the question of the scope of immunity available to PHS personnel under 42 U.S.C. Section 233A. More specifically, the question for the Court is what the plain language of the statute provides in that regard. It is appellant's position that the only way to give any real meaning to Section 233A of the PHS Act is to read the scope of immunity to extend not only to common law torts, but also to Bivens actions. Plain language of the statute makes clear that it is exclusive of all liability. That is to say, the FTCA is the exclusive remedy for all liability arising out of the performance of medical and related functions by PHS officers and civilian employees.
Counsel, though, aren't you overlooking a few things? This statute was passed in 1970 before the Bivens case was decided, wasn't it?
It was.
And subsequent to that time, there have been all kinds of cases and glosses, Carlson being among the most important, that have defined, if you will, a parallel track. Does the government dispute that?
Well, I cannot speak for the government. I'm representing.
Okay. Well, let's take it for the appellate directly.
For the appellants directly, we don't dispute that there that in certain circumstances, in fact, in most circumstances under the FTCA, Bivens claims can proceed parallel to FTCA claims.
But isn't 233A designed to cover garden variety torts, medical claims? I mean, there are many, many statutes. I think I have like 14 that deal with everything from Department of Defense lawyers to people involved in the atomic energy area that refer back to the statute. And yet they're not protected from Bivens claims. So why should the Public Health Service be any different?
Well, I would dispute that I'm presuming that the other statutes to which you're referring include the Gonzales Act, for instance, which appears at 10 U.S.C. 1089. It's certainly not clear that Bivens liability is coextensive with or can run parallel to FTCA liability in that circumstance.
Well, for example, 10 U.S.C. 1054A deals with legal malpractice by Department of Defense lawyers. Are you suggesting that there's no Bivens Act liability for Department of Defense lawyers on extraordinary matters?
I can't speak to that statute because it's not a statute with which I'm familiar. I'm not familiar with the text of what it says. I can't tell you whether it has the same sort of language that...
Well, it refers back to 233A. And I'm sorry, excuse me, it does not refer back to that. It refers back to 1346B and 2672 of Title 28, which is the same remedy section that 233A refers to.
Since I don't have the text of that statute in front of me, I can't speak directly to it. However, the mere fact that it incorporates the remedy available under 1346B and 2672 says nothing of the exclusivity of that remedy. By contrast, when you're looking
at... It says something because the remedy is only as broad, the remedy that's being incorporated is as broad as the remedy is. And if the remedy is, by its own terms, not applicable to some subset of cases, then why isn't that nature of the remedy part of what's being incorporated?
Well, I think that really gets to the nub of the issue here, and I think that's where the confusion in the district court lies. The fact that a remedy might not be exclusive is not to say that remedy is not available. And that's precisely the case that we're looking at, for instance, in the Carlson context or in the post-1988 FTCA context. You can have a remedy against the United States and at the same time a remedy against an individual employee of the federal government directly, absent some sort of expressed exclusive language. That is precisely the language that we are looking at in Section 233A.
First of all, if 2679, if it stood alone, would definitely apply to these people, right? Because it talks about, it applies to all employees. affirmatively and negatively. Because what actually happened was, essentially, Congress later added in the Westfall Act an exclusivity provision for everybody to parallel the one that had existed earlier for 233, and for the public health employees.
I'm sorry.
Is that right?
What the intention, as I understand it from the legislative history to the Westfall Act, is that they wanted to provide a similar exclusive remedy to what was already available to DOD employees, PHSS.
It applies to any employee of the government, so it applies on its face to these same people.
It applies to if I understand what you're asking, what I would suggest is that there are two types of immunity available to PHS employees, depending on the context. They can avail themselves of the protections of 2679B1, or they can avail themselves of the protection of 42 U.S.C. 233A.
They're exactly the same. Are they not exactly the same?
They are not exactly the same, because one is exclusive with certain qualifications, and the other is exclusive in all instances.
How can you read the statute that way, counsel? If you look at 233A, it says the remedy against the United States provided by Section 1346B and 2672 of Title 28, and skipping the alternative, which doesn't apply here, shall be exclusive of any other action. So it tells you where the remedy is found. And in this particular case, you go to 1346B, and that refers to Chapter 171, which includes an express exemption in a section of that for Bivens claims. Why isn't that the remedy?
Well, again, I think it gets back to the question of the availability of the remedy versus the exclusivity of that remedy.
But that's sophistry, isn't it?
It's not sophistry, precisely because there is an available remedy against the United States, even in certain cases.
Well, there is, but as the Supreme Court pointed out in Carlson, there are at least four major differences between a Bivens claim and one against the United States exclusively. One that strikes me as being particularly bizarre, if you follow your line of thinking, is you take medical malpractice. I mean, here in California, there's a $250,000 limit on pain and suffering. Other states have a $1.5 million claim limitation. Others have no limitation at all. Others have some kind of a predicate proceeding that has to follow a filing of such an action. How can that be a substitute for a Bivens claim?
It can be a substitute if Congress expressly declares it to be so.
Well, and if it's equally effective. The sentence is, when defendants show that Congress has provided an alternative remedy which is explicitly declared to be a substitute for recovery directly under the Constitution and viewed as equally effective. Now, didn't in Carlson the Court make it clear that just the ordinary tort claim under the Federal Tort Claims Act is not equally effective?
Well, again, if you're not dealing, if the way that the courts have refined that language in Carlson, including this court, is to read it to say if Congress has expressly declared this remedy to be an exclusive remedy, that is sufficient. You find that in Moore versus Glickman, Your Honor, from 1997, I believe it is. The courts are going to be loath to question the Congress's judgment as to whether a remedy, an exclusive remedy, is an adequate remedy in a particular circumstance.
But where has Congress said that 233A and the remedies provided therein, as you construe it, is a substitute for Bivens? Where is that?
Well, as the Court indicated in, I guess it's footnote 5 in Carlson v. Green, you don't need to have that kind of magic language that says explicitly that this remedy shall be an adequate substitute for a constitutional tort claim directly against an employee under Bivens.
But this was before Bivens, wasn't it?
The time the statute was passed, they weren't doing that because Bivens didn't exist.
That's correct, but you do have the Supreme Court in Carlson, which is post-Bivens, obviously, citing the PHS Act as an example where the Congress has expressly provided the FTCA as an exclusive remedy.
Well, it obviously is an exclusive remedy for something. The question is for what? In other words, this is just an observation, which is true, that 233A is exclusive as to some subset of alternatives. But the question is, what's the subset?
When you look at 233A itself, the text, it's all liability. Unlike the other pre-immunity statutes.
But that statute was enacted before Bivens was decided. So it by no means does it close the field of inquiry, does it?
It closes the field of inquiry as to all liability.
However, Congress changed the law subsequent to that point?
Excuse me?
However, Congress changed the law subsequent to that point?
Well, if you're to suggest that there's a statutory cause of action might arise for...
No, what I'm saying is this. The first part of 233A talks about what the remedy is. It cites other sections. Those other sections have been amended in the references therein. I mean, if you ever done any Internal Revenue Code work, you know that there's a code section here, the code section there, everything refers to this and that and the other. And that's exactly what's happened here. But Congress has provided different things at different times to respond to different circumstances, hasn't it?
They have. But what the Congress did in 233A was to make the FTCA, which is to say the judicial remedy available under 1346B and the administrative remedy under 2672, the exclusive remedy in all instances. Were the Congress to establish a statutory cause of action for other wrongs under federal law, that would be excluded as well unless there is an exception in that law.
But to go back to where I was before, if 233A didn't exist, 2679 would apply both affirmatively and in terms of the exclusion to your clients, right?
If there were no 233A, correct, yes.
All right, because it, on its face it applies.
Correct.
Because it applies to any employee. I mean, you said they could pick and choose. I don't know why that is. But it applies to any employees of the government, of which these people are some.
That's correct. And if I could.
So your burden is to suggest why it would be that when Congress decided to extend the narrow exclusivity of 2333 to all employees, including your clients, and it's also decided that that shouldn't apply to a Bivens remedy. They had any reason to and did pull out your employees from the definition of any employee, and your clients. I mean, to me, this is even simpler than following around the cross references. I mean, it just standing on its face, they made a decision at this point that for all employees, there's an exclusive remedy and an exception. And why 233 then is an exception to that, I don't know.
Well, I think that there are two factors that respond to your question. First, when you look at 2679B2, the first clause of the statute says, subparagraph 1 shall not apply to Bivens actions or other statutory causes of action. It says nothing of 233A. It says nothing of the Gonzales Act. It says nothing of what we refer to here as the pre-immunity statute.
But 233A says that the remedy is within those sections. And if the Congress has changed the remedy, doesn't that also expand or limit the remedy as provided in those two sections?
Well, again, I think it gets back to our disagreement over whether the remedy has changed itself. And it hasn't. There's been no change in the availability of the FTCA remedy, except to the extent that it goes beyond discretionary acts, because the court is aware the Westfall Act arose out of the judicially created doctrine of official immunity based on discretionary functions versus ministerial functions. That's effectively what the Westfall Act did. It eliminated that exception to official immunity. Otherwise, the remedy was unaffected.
And they stated at the time that it wasn't designed to affect constitutional claims, didn't they, in the legislative history?
That's precisely our point, in fact. That's the second answer to Judge Berzon's question, which is it was intended to have no effect on the availability, for good or ill, of constitutional causes of action directly against federal employees. And at that time, Bivens claims were not available against PHS Act employees. Am I just clear from Carlson?
Beginning to run into the government's time, so.
I think I've got 22 seconds.
No, you're over 22 seconds.
Oh, okay.
You're at the trapdoor phase.
Wouldn't be the first time. Thank you for your time.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Now, you're saving 2 minutes for rebuttal?
Yes, please, if the court will allow. Okay. Your Honors, may I please the court? I'm Jeffrey Clare. I'm Justice Department Counsel for the United States, is amicus in this matter. If I might start with Judge Smith's question, why are doctors different here? In 1970, Congress made a legislative policy determination that the prospect of ruinous malpractice judgments and the burdens of having to defend malpractice suits were deterring doctors from coming to work for the federal service and impairing the agency's mission. So it enacted a statute worded in extraordinarily broad terms that makes the Federal Tort Claims Act remedy against the United States the exclusive of any other civil action.
But counsel, and I hate to interrupt you at this early point, but we don't have a lot of time to talk about this. Let's just stipulate that as far as malpractice is concerned, that 233, not just A, but farther on, is just replete with references to malpractice. I mean, there's a, you go back and you find sections 233F, G, I, K, and M, among the ones I found, that talk of 233, that talk about not only how they're going to deal with malpractice, but it gives the secretary the ability not to hire doctors who have a particularly high rate of malpractice claims. It talks about basically arbitrage, whether it makes more sense for the government to have malpractice insurance versus self-insuring. So I think we can stipulate that insofar as ordinary medical malpractice claims are concerned, there's no question that that section is designed to make it the exclusive remedy. But that's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about whether or not Bivens survives this analysis. Now, I would just like to ask you this. You're familiar with the infamous Tuskegee syphilis tests and studies, are you not?
I am.
That was carried on by PHS for almost 40 years to determine whether, as it turned out, African-American men would have certain effects. They just tested whether they're going to die. They didn't give them penicillin and so on. Today, I think it's fair to say that that would have risen well above a constitutional level. Is it the government's position that were the PHS to engage in a Tuskegee syphilis experiment today, that there would be no constitutional claim against the PHS because of 233A?
It is, Your Honor. Even for the most egregious misconduct such as that, so long as those PHS doctors are acting within the scope of their employment, Congress has said that the remedy for any injuries they inflict is solely against the United States pursuant to the Federal Tort Claims Act, and that the language that would exclude even the most egregious of constitutional claims is right in the operative provisions of Section 233A itself, that says with respect to injuries arising out of medical functions performed by public health service doctors, the Federal Tort Claims Act remedy is exclusive of any civil action. And we'd
what about two, what about 233E, which says...
Well, Your Honor, that, if I might, that I think illustrates the point that Congress has focused on public health service doctors and enacted a scheme that is particularly applicable to the problems and policy concerns that are presented by public health service employees alone. And what's important...
But that section, which is part of the same section of the code on which the government and the petitioner or the appellant relies, deals with doctors, and it says that assaults and batteries arising out of negligence in performing medical, surgical, dental, or related functions is not covered exclusively, right?
Your Honor, and if I might, what that provision actually does is that makes public health service doctors, makes claims arising out of their treatment for a battery committed by providing medical care without informed consent actionable under the Federal Tort Claims Act, even though if the Federal Tort Claims Act applied, such claims would be barred by the intentional tort exception.
But that seems to me to run in the opposite direction for our problem, because there is no exception for 2679. In other words, in Congress in 233, and I understand that there are time factors here in terms of what happened in what order, but at the time that the Westfall Act was passed, and Congress said, as I read it, for all employees of the government, the remedy, the FTCA remedy is exclusive, except not for Bivens actions. If they wanted to create an express exception of the kind Carlson talks about to 1233, they could have done that. But instead, one reads this, first of all, you have cross references, but also you have the fact that 2679 on its face applies to all federal employees.
Well, Your Honor, let me take your last statement first. Yes, that is true. But for Section 233, the Westfall Act provisions would apply to these employees as well. And the exception for Bivens' claim would apply to Bivens' employees as well. But the salient point here is that Congress did enact.
Exception. I mean, one interesting thing is that it's not written as an exception. It's written, as I am reading it, essentially as a construction. Paragraph 1 does not extend or apply to a civil action. It doesn't say except that it doesn't apply. It's simply telling us that it doesn't apply. And in that sense, it seems to me, supports the notion that it doesn't apply in 233A either. That language doesn't mean this is what they're saying.
Well, Your Honor, I agree that what it says is that the prior section does not apply. But that's consistent with the legislative history of the Westfall Act, which shows that Congress intended simply to leave the state of the law as it applied the constitutional law towards unchanged. You have those statements.
That's right, but we don't know what the state of the law with regard to 233A at that point, because nobody had ever construed it with regard to Bivens actions.
Well, Your Honor, there is the plain language of 233A, which extends to any civil action, and certainly that would contemplate an action under the Constitution. Now, I think much has been made here of the fact that Bivens case postdates the enactment of this statute. This is a 1970 statute.
That the general, that what 233A was about malpractice cases. And one anomaly of the way that you're reading all this is that for constitutional violations, if you can't, it's one thing to say that for a malpractice claim, you're going to look to different state laws and people will recover whatever the state law allows. But the consequence of this, aside from who you can sue, is also that if you have a constitutional violation in New York or in California, then you have a completely differential ability to recover something approximating your lawsuit. Right?
Well, it is true that under the Federal Tort Claims Act, local law does.
That's true, and it makes sense for torts that are parallel to state torts. But for torts that aren't parallel to state torts, that are constitutional torts, what sense does it make?
Well, Your Honor, because Congress was concerned simply with insulating doctors from liability, not with the nature of the cause of action, the sources of law on which the claims were predicated.
Can I ask a question about that?
Certainly.
Did the doctors, in fact, have any chance of having to pay this? Is there an indemnity provision under for federal law such that if they are held liable, that their expenses of defense and damages will be paid?
That there is a law that pertains to indemnity, but it does not say what Your Honor has stated.
I'm sorry, I can't hear you.
There is an indemnification regulation that applies to these doctors. It is 45 CFR Part 36. It provides that in the sole discretion of the Secretary of Health and Human Services, indemnification may be paid or may not be paid. There is authority to indemnify the doctors against such a judgment, but there is no compulsion that they do so.
Are the doctors currently paying their own lawyers?
Their legal expenses are reimbursed by the United States, yes. Again, pursuant to discretionary provisions that leave the decision as to whether to afford that indemnification solely to the discretion of the administrative officials. I think, Your Honor, it's with respect, inappropriate to suggest that this is really an action against the United States because, well, of course, the action, the United States is going to pay. There is no statute that requires such
payment. No, I understand that. But in terms of whether, I mean, it seems to me that with regard to malpractice, well, what about with regard to malpractice? Is the same indemnity provision?
It is the same, yes, ma'am. And again, it is a discretionary determination. The decision as to whether to indemnify lies solely with senior managerial personnel within the pertinent administrative
agency. Well, if you think that Congress was so concerned with seeing the doctors did not have to pay, then the government can certainly carry out the will of Congress.
Well, Your Honor, I think first and foremost our mm-hmm. task is to apply the statute here mm-hmm. as written. And the statute as written says that all such actions, any civil action arising out of such medical injuries are excluded. It draws no distinctions between common law torts and constitutional torts. It is not concerned with the categories of causes of action or the sources of substantive law that underlie the cause of action.
Yeah, I think you were going to make an argument about when Bivens was passed was irrelevant, was it?
Well, yes, Your Honor. I think the notion is that because Bivens wasn't established at the time of mm-hmm. Bivens hadn't been decided at the time this statute was enacted in 1970, somehow Congress couldn't possibly have contemplated excluding constitutional claims. And I think a wider view of the history of the Bivens remedy refutes that notion. First and foremost, cert was granted in Bivens in June of 1970. This statute was enacted in December of 1970. So the question of whether such a damages remedy should be afforded was already before the Supreme Court when the Congress enacted this statute. Secondly, the very opening lines of Bivens make clear that it is deciding, in deciding this constitutional damages remedy question, it is deciding an issue that was expressly left open by the Supreme Court in Bell v. Hood, a case dating back to 1946. All the substantive law that the court relies on in Bivens, the court's power to fashion an appropriate remedy and to look to a damages remedy for claims that are within the federal court's jurisdiction, relies on a chain of cases long predating this statute, starting with Bell v. Hood in 1946 and stretching all the way back to Marbury v. Madison. Congress had before it examples of other statutes that provided damages remedies for constitutional violations.
Would the government agree that these statutes are not artfully drafted?
Well, I always find difficulty in teasing the meaning out of the statute at first reading, and I think that is true here.
They are at best ambiguous, are they not, in the aggregate?
Your Honor, I would not agree that Section 233 is ambiguous with respect to the scope of the exclusivity.
Even when you include the remedy section.
Well, I was hoping to come to that the argument, the rationale principally relied on by the district court, which is a kind of double incorporation by reference argument. The notion is that Section 233 incorporates by reference the jurisdictional provision of the Federal Tort Claims Act, Section 1346B, which in turn incorporates by reference
Where else do you find a remedy if you don't do that, though?
Well, you do find a remedy because the Section 233 says points at the Federal Tort Claims Act and says that is your exclusive remedy. But the question of the scope of that exclusivity is resolved right in the operative provisions of Section 233 itself. One problem we see in the district court's analysis is that there simply is no language of incorporation by reference. It does not say.
Does there have to be?
I to support the district court's rationale and the arguments advanced by plaintiff, I think there does have.
How could the Internal Revenue Code even function without, if you have to have incorporation by reference, the Internal Revenue Code just dissolves into a mass of kryptonite?
Well,
there's one section all over the place. I mean, this section refers to that section, the other section, that you can't even understand it without looking at five or six different sections every time you look. And this is really no different, is it?
Well, I think it is different, Your Honor, because the statute is solely about defining the exclusivity of the Federal Tort Claims Act in this particular context. why the court should then proceed to look at a provision that.
But it's subject to.
That the jurisdictional provision of the Federal Tort Claims Act is subject to the provisions of Chapter 171 of Title 28. 18 years after the enactment of this statute, Congress added
You just mentioned jurisdiction. I mean, the statute begins, 233A, remedy provided by Section 1346B. And as you pointed out, Section 1346B is a jurisdictional section. It doesn't even provide a remedy. Well, answer to Judge Smith's question of whether it's ambiguous has to be yes.
Well, Your Honor, again, we respectfully disagree. Yes, 1346B is in part a jurisdictional provision, but we do agree with the plaintiffs to this extent. The references to 1346B and 2672 of Title 28 are a typical statutory shorthand for referring to the Federal Tort Claims Act. I think there's no ambiguity.
There's an easier way to refer to the Federal Tort Claims Act than to pick out one paragraph that's a jurisdictional provision and say that the remedy provided by that jurisdictional provision. They could have said by the Federal Tort Claims Act. They could have given any section that provides the remedy. They could have, given the code citations for the act.
Certainly, Your Honor, Congress could have made reference to remedy in some other way.
But they didn't really do it this way. They did it by referring to a section that doesn't, in fact, provide a remedy.
Your Honor, then I would be hard-pressed to see how the entire statutory scheme could operate in that circumstance.
No, you'd have to say it's ambiguous. And
you said there's no incorporation by reference. Well, isn't the only way to read this and make any sense is that there is incorporation by reference? That is, that the reference to 1346 had to be a reference to the subject to the provisions of Chapter 171 and essentially to incorporate 171. What else does it mean? The only way you get from the 1346 reference to where we all agree you have to get, including you, which is to the incorporation of the Federal Tort Claims Act, is through subject to the provisions of Chapter 171 of this title, right?
Well, again, Your Honor, I would balk at the notion that there is an incorporation by reference. The Federal Tort Claims Act was an existing remedy at the time this statute was enacted. What this statute does is to point at that existing remedy and to say for a particular class of conduct, that remedy is exclusive.
And what's the difference between that and an incorporation by reference? I don't understand it.
Because we're dealing here with the scope of the exclusivity provision, not the provisions that provide the remedy that is made exclusive. And the scope of the exclusivity is determined simply by the operative provisions of the face of Section 2.
What do you understand subject to the provisions of Chapter 171 of this title to mean?
I mean, I would understand that to mean that the Federal Tort Claims Act remedy, the various things that you can recover for under the Federal Tort Claims Act, are defined in part by some of the provisions of subchapter.
It doesn't say that. It says all of them. It says subject to the provisions of Chapter 171 of this title.
Well, Your Honor, subchapter 171 includes a number of things that are obviously unrelated to that, including a provision directing reports to be filed to Congress.
But this one on its face does apply. This one on its face applies, as we already agreed at the outset. It applies to any employee of the federal government.
It does not, however, alter the scope the types of things you can recover for under the Federal Tort Claims Act or the circumstances in which you can have a judgment against the United States under the Federal Tort Claims Act. What 2679 does is it says when you have such a remedy, it discusses when that remedy is exclusive of other remedies. Nothing in 2679 changes what kinds of causes of action you can bring against the federal government, what items of damages you can claim, what circumstances the government will be liable. It simply has no bearing on any of those things.
All right. You're over 5 minutes over.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you, counsel.
May it please the Court. My name is Connell Doyle, and I represent the estate of Francisco Castaneda through his sister, Danira Castaneda, as the personal representative, as well as his sole heir, Vanessa Castaneda, his 15-year-old daughter. They wanted to be here today, but Vanessa is in Arizona, and Danira has child care responsibilities. Thank you for expediting the briefing on this important case and expediting the hearing. I think that everyone here agrees on the issue. That is, whether the district court properly interpreted 42 U.S.C. 233A as permitting plaintiffs to assert Bivens claims, because the plain language of that statute, following the statutory trail to the FTCA, expressly preserves the right to bring Bivens actions.
Mr. Doyle, the Carlson case has facts that are somewhat similar to this. But there's a troubling comment in Carlson. I'll just read it briefly. Says this conclusion, referring to that the FTCA complements Bivens, is buttressed by the significant fact that Congress follows the practice of explicitly stating what it when it means to make FTCA an exclusive remedy. Then, among other statutes, it cites 42 U.S.C. Section 233A. What implication, if any, does that have on your case?
Your Honor, Carlson set forth a two-part test for determining whether or not a statute could provide exclusivity. The first part of that test is an explicit declaration by Congress that there is a substitute remedy. The second part of the test, which Judge Reinhart alluded to in argument, was that alternative remedy has to be equally effective in the view of Congress. And this statement in the Carlson case just recognizes the fact that Carlson, that 233A, as well as a number of other immunity statutes, provide an exclusive remedy for malpractice by government health personnel. That's exactly what the language says, malpractice by certain government health personnel. And so, as Judge Berzon indicated earlier, the issue is what is the scope of the immunity? I mean, we don't disagree that 233A provides immunity for malpractice claims, which are different from constitutional claims. And so, because the Supreme Court chose its words carefully, just like this Court does in writing opinions, after going through an analysis of the difference between the FTCA and Bivens claims, going through the four-part test, Judge Smith, that you indicated, you talked about earlier, finding specifically that, and I'm going to read this quote out of Carlson. It's on page 23. Plainly, FTCA is not a sufficient protector of a citizen's constitutional rights, and without a clear congressional mandate, we cannot hold that Congress relegated respondent exclusively to the FTCA remedy. Now, 233A does exactly that. I mean, 233A says your alternative remedy is the FTCA. So the Supreme Court in Carlson goes to great lengths to say it's not in a discussion in a Bivens context, then says, well, 233A and these other statutes provide that explicit declaration. If they meant to say that it extended to Bivens claims, they certainly would have said so. They didn't. They carefully said it applies to malpractice by government health personnel.
So you don't view the court's comment on page 19 that the Section 233A was an example of the kind of explicit statement by Congress that this was intended as a substitute for a Bivens claim?
Correct. I don't.
Any other way that, other than the language of the opinion itself, any other way that you would distinguish that aspect of Carlson that would help your case?
You know, I think that you have to look at kind of timeline sequence of events of cases, and I think that helps. So, you know, and this goes outside the language of Carlson, but if you look at the timeline of events here, we talked about the fact that 233A was enacted in 1970. Bivens didn't come down until June of 1971, 6 months after 233A. But the other thing that no one's talked about, and I just actually realized it yesterday while I was preparing in the airport, in 1970,
you must have had a lot of time to prepare.
I did. The Supreme Court in Estelle v. Gamble for the first time recognized an Eighth Amendment violation for failure to provide medical care to prisoners. So not only did a Bivens claim not exist in 1970, but there was no cause of action under the Constitution for violation of the Eighth Amendment. And so the Estelle versus Gamble set forth kind of the legal test that on the merits we have to establish here in this case, that, you know, there was deliberate indifference to a serious medical need. But that didn't exist back in 1970. So there simply is no way that you can read 233A as satisfying the Carlson test, that particularly the second part of the test, which requires Congress to determine that there is an alternative, or that the alternative remedy is equally effective. Because, I mean, Bivens didn't exist, and neither did the claim that's at issue here today.
Admittedly, the Second Circuit's cases are not binding on us, but how do you address Cuoco?
In a number of different ways. I mean, the most obvious is that Cuoco does not discuss at all the Liability Reform Act of 1988, which effectively amended 233A by expressly preserving a Bivens remedy and clarifying the law that existed prior to 1988, for one. The facts of that case are very different than ours as well. It's a transsexual, male-to-female transsexual case.
You're distinguishing it on the basis of which type of constitutional remedy there is, or if it rises to a constitutional level, right?
I don't think the facts really should have that much effect here. But I think that they sometimes color decisions. I'm not suggesting that particular constitutional violation in that case is any different for our purposes here today. No.
Well, didn't the court there find that what happened did not rise to the level of a constitutional claim in any event?
You know, I don't know that the court came to that conclusion. I mean, the court assumed for the purposes of the case that there was a serious medical need.
Right.
The court may have found that. There was no deliberate indifference. But as it pertains to the legal issue that's before us today, a couple other things the court didn't do, which is significant, is it never analyzed the four factors that Carlson set forth, and it never even discussed Carlson at all. And it didn't discuss that two-part test where you have to show the second part of the test, that Congress determined that this other alternative remedial scheme is equally effective. So,
counsel, your opponent said that the answer to that is it found in our case, the Moore case. Do you have a response to that? That Moore said that if Congress did the first part and excluded it, that meant it found it equally effective.
Yeah, you know, the Moore case, I haven't read the Moore case, Your Honor. I wrote that down when counsel cited it, but I'm not familiar with it.
Okay.
I think it was a Ninth Circuit case that he referred to, but it doesn't change, it can't change the Supreme Court's.
No, but it would bind us.
Well, I think that the Supreme Court's test in Carlson is still the applicable test that the court has to go through to reach the end conclusion here, and that being that there is that requirement to find that it's equally effective.
It is true, I think, that if today they passed the same provision as 233A and we didn't have a complication of 2679, you would perhaps assume that they made the determination with regard to a Bivens action, but A, it didn't exist at the time, so it seems a little odd to think that they made a determination that it's equally effective because they didn't know about it, for both reasons that you suggested. So the time sequence seems to fit into that matter as well, I think. I have a completely different question, just to be sure I understand what we're doing here today. Is there any issue before us now other than the statutory question? In other words, what about looking at the pleadings to determine whether these individuals, whether they're sufficient to allege what you would have to allege, the higher constitutional standard with regard to each of these individuals? Is anybody contesting that? Is that a problem we need to deal with?
Well, I understand that Mr. Hennifer has filed a brief. He was a health services administrator at the San Pedro facility, which was, Mr. Castaneda was detained at two separate facilities. The first one was San Diego Correctional Facility from March 27th of 2006 to approximately November 23rd of 2006. He was then transferred to San Pedro and was there from November 24th approximately to February 5th, 2007 when he was released. Mr. Henneford was the health services administrator in that facility. He's the only one that's raised before this court any issue about whether the factual allegations are sufficient as to him.
All right. Now, what I'm asking you is, does that question, either with respect to him or anyone else, before us on this qualified, not qualified, but immunity appeal at this point?
I don't think so. I mean, this is an appeal of absolute immunity. Denial of absolute immunity. The issue that Mr. Henneford raised, I believe, is one of qualified immunity, that being whether or not the law was clearly established at the time he acted that what he was doing was unlawful, which goes to the factual allegations of the complaint.
Was that raised at the district court level?
It wasn't, not specifically by Mr. Henneford. I mean, the United States, who was representing all these individuals at the time, suggested in his brief that the medical care provided Mr. Castaneda did not rise to the level of a constitutional claim. That was very soundly rejected by the district court.
Now, for our purposes and following up on what Judge Berzon indicated, normally when something's not raised at the district court level, it can be waived. Was there anything raised at the district court level on behalf of Mr. Henneford in terms of qualified immunity, or for our purposes to the degree we even have any role in considering that, is it waived?
It is waived. It was not preserved below.
How can that be fair to him, since at the time that this occurred, he did not have individual counsel, but rather was represented by the United States, if you will, the ultimate payor in such a situation? Were his interests adequately represented by the United States at that point, or is it fair to have this issue waived in terms of qualified immunity, if you ever get to that, since he didn't have his own counsel at the time?
Well, I'm not suggesting that it's waived for the entire purposes of this case. He's the opportunity when, if he's still in the case after this appeal, to raise qualified immunity down the road in another motion to dismiss, perhaps, or at the Rule 56 level. So his qualified immunity, I didn't mean to suggest that his qualified immunity defense was entirely waived for the whole case. I'm just saying that for the purposes of this appeal, it wasn't raised below, and you know, it's...
So for your perspective, that's not even before us at this point.
That's just not before us. Okay.
But see, what's odd about this is that I'm not sure it is only pertinent to a qualified immunity defense, because in this instance, we have one level of allegation that is precluded and another level that is not precluded on your theory of the case, right? So you have to at least allege enough to make up that increment. And I guess the question is whether... making up that increment includes demonstrating that he, Henneford, and each of the other individuals had both the knowledge and was so situated as to come under the Estelle standard. So that's what's really bothering me. I mean, is there something more we would need to decide other than how that the Bivens action does potentially survive, but do we have to demonstrate that it actually survived under these circumstances?
This appeal, from our point of view, our understanding is that it's just an absolute immunity appeal, and the factual allegations of the complaint aren't at issue. However, I'll address it. Mr. Henneford received a letter on December 5th of 2006. He was copied on a letter that was sent by Tom Jowitz, who is a member of the ACLU National Prison Project. He had been corresponding with Mr. Castaneda for a number of months and had obtained some medical records from his outside physicians that the government had sent him to that documented clearly that he needed a biopsy to rule out cancer. The letter was sent to Henneford as well as a number of other defendants on December 5th. Letters and follow-up phone calls are made to that facility, and he's the health services administrator, the head administrative official for that as it pertains to health care for the facility. This is all in the record. Mr. Jowitz has filed a declaration with exhibits. It's in the record as well. And two or three other times, letters were sent from the ACLU of Southern California to the facility, informing them of what was happening. Mr. Jowitz's letter, when you review it, will demonstrate that he set forth in detail Mr. Castaneda's condition, the fact that he had been diagnosed with potentially having cancer, needed a biopsy as soon as possible, needed to rule out cancer, a deadly disease. He was detained at that facility until February 5, 2007, when he was released. He was never provided the biopsy during the course of his detention, although on this January 25th, they sent him to two outside physicians. They sent him to somebody on December 14th, a doctor by the name of Lawrence Greenberg, who said he needed a biopsy to rule out cancer. They then sent him to another physician to get another opinion, Dr. Akbar Asghari on January 25th, who said he needed a biopsy to rule out cancer. It was scheduled for February 8th. They released him 3 days before, and the biopsy point was canceled by the United States government. So he was never provided this care that was recommended by his outside physicians that the government sent him to. Mr. Henneford was well aware of that. He was in an administrative position where he was responsible for taking care of that. So I clearly believe that if we have to reach that issue at this level.
Which issue? Have to reach which issue?
The issue of whether the complaint states facts sufficient to rise to the level of a constitutional violation as to Mr. Henneford solely. So moving on to the district court's opinion in this case, the plain language of the statute clearly controls the court's analysis here today, and as the court has noted.
Well, you both seem to think plain language controls. I'm glad the statute is all that clear to both of you.
Well, on 233's face, you have to look to the incorporated provision. So. But when you follow the statutory trail and when there's language that says subject to the Glickman case, it's a Ninth Circuit case that the district court cited, it's in our briefs, that you know, talked about a case where a statute said subject to Section 318 of the Department of Interior Appropriations Act to determine the scope of timber sales permitted in another statute. So this is a common statutory construction the courts do. You always look to the incorporated provisions. It would be like, I mean, under their analysis, it would be like reading the first three lines of 233A, but not reading the rest. I mean, you have to construe the statute as a whole, and you have to follow the trail to where it goes. And when you do that,
but you do agree, do you not, that these statutes are very poorly drafted and very poorly coordinated?
I would agree that could have been cleaner. I think, you know, we probably say that about a lot of statutes, but
maybe all of them,
perhaps. And, you know, to the extent that we believe that the language is plain and unambiguous, but even if it's not, and you have to resort to looking at legislative history, the legislative history in this case is equally direct. And I'll address that briefly.
Is there any authority or statement or statute of which you are aware where Congress has indicated clearly, as required by Carlson, that 233A is the exclusive remedy to take the place of a Bivens action?
There's no statute that I'm aware of or that's been cited by any party in this case.
Any case law?
Well, there are the cases, starting with Quacko, mm-hmm. the 2000 Second Circuit case,
right.
And his progeny. There's a number of district court cases.
But those all followed Quacko in the Second Circuit, right?
Right, primarily.
Anything in the Ninth Circuit or any of our district courts that provide any authority?
No. I mean, there are some cases that support our position that talk about a Bivens claim being viable in the context of 233A, although they don't address specifically the issue of medical care. In an employment context, a Bivens claim was determined to be viable against a public health service doctor. But I'm running out of time. There's a couple of points I want to make sure that I raise in response to some of the arguments raised in the brief. And the brief from Mr. Malacio, I believe is the way it's pronounced, referenced or argued that the district court's reading of 2679 rendered 233A superfluous as a whole. And I just want to make sure that the court is aware, because it wasn't in our briefs, that 233 itself has an independent meaning and an independent basis for existing separate and apart from the Federal Tort Claims Act, because it does provide immunity to other classes of employees who otherwise would not be protected by the Federal Tort Claims Act. And if you look at 233 G, O, and P, you'll see that. There's a mechanism set forth in 233A for deeming someone who's otherwise not a government employee an employee just for the purposes of immunity. It applies to, I think, free health clinics and administration of smallpox vaccine and health clinics that satisfy a certain standard. These folks are not government employees, and they ordinarily wouldn't be provided the protection of the FTCA but for 233A. And 233G states that provides this mechanism by deeming the employee to be an employee of the Public Health Service Act, and then references 233A. So the court's analysis does not render 233A superfluous, and Congress in 1988 did not render 233A superfluous as a whole by creating this.
Would it be fair to say that Congress, by failing to state anything to the contrary, allowed Bivens' actions and the ordinary tort claims approach under 233A to proceed on, if you will, a parallel track? They are separate in some respects, but clearly divisible types of actions that pertain, in this case, to medical personnel.
Yes, and it's interesting to note that if you look at the legislative history of the Liability Reform Act, it says, it's not supposed to change any law that happened before that, but there were no cases decided on this issue. There's none of the cases out there. Like Quacko was decided in 2000, but from 1970 to 1988, there wasn't a single decision that addressed this issue. And it wasn't until 2000 that there was a circuit court opinion that addressed this issue at all. So, I mean, the argument that the public policy argument from the appellants that this would open the floodgate to litigation against these doctors, may be overburdened by litigation, I think is mitigated by the fact that there were no reported decisions on this issue.
What impact, if any, does Moore have on our deliberations? The Moore case.
Again, I can't address the
Moore case.
Oh,
that's right. You said you were.
The test, presumably, of whether there would be a floodgate, maybe parallel causes of action that are still in prisons, which proceed under Carlson and are not covered by 233. And I don't know what the answer is, except that still is a pretty high standard.
It is, and
do you have any information at all on that?
Well, I can tell you anecdotally, for the first 6 years of my practice, I defended governmental entities in these cases, in these medical neglect cases brought against local governmental entities, sheriff's office, the state of Florida. And, probably 90% of my cases, maybe 95%, were disposed of at Rule 12, and 99% of them at Rule 56. I mean, I had a handful of cases in maybe a 2,000-person facility going on at any one time. So, they're there. The cases come. I don't think that there's a floodgate that will open. And I think that the fact that, from 1970 to 1988, there was not a single case, and it took 30 years for the first reported circuit court case speaks volumes to that.
But that's really not before us right now, right? Whether the pleading is sufficient to make out a Bivens claim.
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
So our from your perspective, our role is simply to determine whether, in light of the statutory discussions we've had and Bivens and Carlson and so on, whether if there is an adequately pleaded and proven Bivens case, it can succeed directly against the individual, Dr. Hannaford and others, and not be limited exclusively as a claim against the government. Is that correct?
That's correct. Although if you were to reach the issue of the factual sufficiency of the allegations, and in this case, let me just make sure the court is aware. The facts that have been set out by the district court and the facts that are set forth in our brief are not just allegations. They're the undisputed evidence in the case. Every single fact that's referenced is either came from the deposition of Dr. Hoy, the government employee, or the official government medical record.
I guess my point, though, Mr. Coyle, is that the briefs and so on in this case don't really focus on that, do they? Aren't we dealing with this other issue?
Yes, sir. Okay. And before I close, I just wanted to address a couple of the issues that have been raised as it relates to the implied repeal and whether or not constitutional claims are cognizable in this context. And I've pulled the brief of the United States in the Smith case, which was talked about in district court opinion. One of the authors is Barbara Herwig, who's also one of the authors of this, of the amicus brief filed in this case. One of the first headings in the brief states that under the Reform Act, the exclusive remedy for all claims arising from torts committed by federal employees acting within the scope of their employment, except for claims arising from violations of the Constitution or a federal statute, is a suit against the United States under the Federal Tort Claims Act. And so, you know, the United States has taken the position that these claims, these types of claims, constitutional claims, are accepted in all circumstances. They also, in the brief at page 16, talked about a conflict between the FTCA and the Gonzales Act, interpreting whether the interplay between the Gonzales Act and the FTCA, and indicated that the FTCA would apply, lending credence to the fact that you have to look at the FTCA because it applies to these statutes under that reference to 1346 and 2672. Page 33-36 is a discussion about why the Gonzales Act does not foreclose the application of the Reform Act to this case. And it talks about how you have to look at the Federal Tort Claims Act in connection with the Gonzales Act.
What was the precise issue in Smith?
The precise issue in Smith. Was whether or not 2680 of the Federal Tort Claims Act, which is the foreign tort exception, would apply to bar the claim entirely. So the Gonzales Act suggested there was a remedy against the United States under the FTCA, but when you go to the FTCA, it bars the claim. And so the Supreme Court found that there was no, the ultimate holding was that there was no claim against a physician because of the foreign tort exception. But the point I wanted to make is this, is that in footnote 21, the last, right before the conclusion in their brief, they say, whether or not that impression was correct, there is no doubt Congress intended physicians to receive the same protection as other employees. And that's really, the crux of the issue here in this case is do these physicians get special treatment in the Bivens context? Whether you follow the statutory trail, as the district court did from 233A to the plain language of 2679, or Judge Berzon, as you suggested, whether you just look at the Federal Tort Claims Act in 2679 and see that it applies to all federal employees except for Bivens actions, you have to come to the same conclusion, that being that the plain language and Congress's intent is not to preempt or preclude Bivens actions against public health service doctors. If the panel doesn't have any other questions, those are all the comments that I have.
Thank you, Cameron.
Government doesn't have any time left. Is that going to get
They seem to.
I'll be very brief, Your Honor.
It's over there, non-Republican.
Okay.
Yeah. Your Honor, I did want to address first Judge Berzon's question about whether there is a question before the court of whether these the complaint states a claim in the first instance for purposes of a qualified immunity test. In the
what I asked, it wasn't for purposes of the qualified immunity test. It was for purposes of the difference between the exclusivity and a Bivens action, if there is a Bivens action. In other words, whether or not one has to demonstrate, well, one of the issues before us is whether the allegations are sufficient to make up that increment so that this is at least facially a Bivens action and not malpractice action.
I see.
Isn't that at least conceptually part of our problem, if it hasn't been waived, which it may have been?
Well, yeah, I think the only question that was litigated below and presented here is the scope of Section 232.
Okay. Right. Well, that, so you agree with plaintiff's lawyer that there is no other issue?
Not before the court. We would not think that it's waived. The United States took the position.
It's not that it's waived. It's that it hasn't been litigated on the immunity appeal at this point.
That's correct. With respect to the Westfall Act and whether it was intended to exclude constitutional torts for these employees as well, I wanted to refer the Court briefly to some legislative history. These are the hearings that our plaintiff has cited and relied on. I'm going to quote briefly from page 40, which is a colloquy between the chairman of the committee that held these hearings, Barney Frank, and another congressman who was testifying. And he says, one issue I would like to make
public. What's the date of these hearings?
They are just prior to the Westfall Act 1988, I believe, April 88. We're wrong. One issue I should make public here, and I want to let everyone know that this is one of the things that we're going to be concerned about. There is a separate and much more controversial issue, it seems to me, about the whole issue of constitutional torts. And there have been decisions which allow suits against employees where there is an allegation that an intentional act was committed that diminished someone's constitutional rights. It is my intention to see that we get legislation here which does not impinge on that controversy. And I think all sides agree that we do not want to do anything in this issue. We want to preserve the rights of federal employees, and I think it is possible for us to do it in a way that will not impinge one way or the other on that controversy. Now, that's
well, that doesn't help you, does it?
Well, it suggests, Your Honor, that the Westfall Act, as I indicated earlier, was simply to leave the state of the law as it pertained to constitutional torts unchanged.
Right. So if Bivens Act claims survive a 233A analysis, which I know you dispute, then they would not have been affected by the Westfall Act.
I believe that's correct, yes, Your Honor. But there is the rub, of course, that our position is.
I understand.
The Section 233
does. Can you briefly address Smith before you sit down?
Yes, Your Honor. There were no Bivens claims at issue in Smith. Smith was an action brought by a plaintiff who had been injured by a
letter. It does have to do with what the language that I view as incorporating and that you view as not incorporating means. In other words, it essentially says that what was, in the context of the Gonzales Act, that as I understand it, that the employees there were subject, that the immunity that they were given was the entire immunity of the 14th Claims Act, sort of positively and negatively, in both directions.
Well, Your Honor, I'd respectfully disagree for this reason. What the Court held in Smith was that the immunity statute in question there, the Gonzales Act, simply didn't apply in the first instance to the type of claim that plaintiff brought, and that therefore there was no issue of coordinating the Gonzales Act and the subsequently enacted Bivens Act because the Immunity Act simply didn't extend that protection to the plaintiff in the first instance. That is why, in that case, the Court said the presumption against the implied repeals simply had no application because it didn't affect
but
any right.
But subsection B, where they say that there's extra second, a slightly different argument, that the Liability Reform Act was meant to apply solely to those government employees not already protected from tort liability by pre-existing federal immunity statute. Isn't that a somewhat parallel question?
Well, I think it's similar, but subject to the same answer. I think plaintiff's argument, the slight variant of the argument I alluded to previously was
not hearing it.
The plaintiff made an argument that is a slight variant of the argument I alluded to previously, which was that Congress had, in effect, carved out a sphere of influence for these employees in the Gonzales Act, and it was because of that sphere that the Gonzales Act controlled, even if it didn't provide any specific substantive protection with respect to the claim at issue.
We've gone over double your rebuttal time. So.
Okay. Well, thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate the opportunity to appear as amicus.
Thank you. Thank you, all of you, counsel. Our case just argued will be submitted. The Court will stand in recess for the day.
Thank you.